From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. On today's edition of Fresh Air, I speak with basketball's Red Holzman. He's just written a memoir of his more than 50 years as a player, scout, coach, and general manager, a career that's earned him a place in the Pro Basketball Hall of Fame. Also today, I speak with crime writer Charles Williford. His three popular novels, featuring Miami detective Hoke Mosley, have also renewed interest in Williford's early books, originally published as pulp novels in the 1950s. Rock and roll historian Ed Ward profiles the Standells, the 60s group which hit it big with their homage to Boston, Dirty Water. And book critic John Leonard reviews 2061, the latest chapter in the space odyssey of science fiction writer Arthur C. Clarke. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. Red Holzman's career in basketball predates the formation of the National Basketball Association. Now he has a place in the Hall of Fame. His career not only parallels the growth of the NBA, but Holzman also contributed to the popularity of the game. He built the team in the biggest city in the country into the best team in the country. Holzman learned to play in the schoolyards of Brooklyn, New York. He played professionally with the Rochester Royals and the Milwaukee Hawks. In 1958, the New York Knicks made him their scout and assistant coach. After close to 10 years on the road searching for new talent, he was promoted to the job of coach. 3 years later, he led the Knicks to their first world championship. 3 years after that, they won it again. Since retiring in 1983, Holzman has had the chance to look back on his life. He's just written an autobiography titled Red on Red. I spoke with him earlier today from the NPR Bureau in New York. We started off talking about the beginning of his career, playing with the Rochester Royals, who wanted him on the team because he was Jewish.
You know, those days they had a lot of Jewish fans coming to the Rochester games, and they looked at things like that. You know, they needed to have an Italian player. These people came, they wanted to have somebody of their own to cheer for, and they got Fuzzy Levain, who's unfortunately for them at the time, he was Italian, and they thought he was Jewish. So the owner of the team told him to get me, you know, not get me specifically. He said to get a Jewish player. He said he didn't care if he could play or not, but they had to have one on the team.
Could you play?
Oh, yeah, I was pretty good. You know, and then I became an all-league player that year, and I was rookie of the year. I was pretty good.
So that's changed, hasn't it?
Oh, yeah, I think that's changed a great deal. I think, and rightly so, people are trying to get the best possible players, and they... You know, regardless of anything, they don't look at any of that stuff.
You were playing with the Rochester Royals when the Basketball Association of America formed in competition with the National Basketball League. Mm-hmm. This is what, in the late 40s?
Yeah, this was the late 40s. I started with Rochester in the 45-46 season, and the BAA started in 46-47 season.
And then the BAA became the NBA,
which
is what we have now. Now, how did the game change for you while you were playing during these transitions?
Well, we played in the National League, which was the big league at the time when I joined the Rochester Royals, and we played there. And really, it became more of a national game, you know, where they were getting into the big cities, and they used the arenas, the ice hockey arenas. And they were playing there, and actually the game changed in that you got a lot of bigger players, taller players at each position. They weren't as good as we were starting out. The teams weren't, but they gradually caught up, and they were smart enough to take our best teams from the National League and bring them into the NBA. And we had probably two of the best teams in basketball at the time, in Rochester Royals and the Minneapolis Lakers with George Mikan.
A lot of teams from small towns collapsed after the NBA was formed. Do you think that was a big loss to basketball?
It was a big loss, but it was inevitable. I mean, it was getting to the point where money was, you know, becoming more and more, expenses were higher, and everything was going up, salaries were going up. And these places, most of these small towns had arenas that held 3,500, 4,000 people. And it was just impossible with the amount of traveling you had to do and so forth. So, but that was a great type of basketball where you got into these towns and they rooted for their team, and you had to be real good to overcome that kind of thing.
You started scouting after you stopped playing. When did you know that it was time to give up playing?
Well, I knew that quite a while, I think. You know, I was really losing a lot of interest in playing. I was I didn't enjoy it as much as I used to, and I was starting to think a bit about the future. I was about 34 years old when I gave it up, or they gave me up, you know. And as I was finishing up, the coach, Fuzzy Levine, strangely enough, he was fired, and I took his place. So that started me on my coaching career. And I didn't have to really worry about a great transition. I went right from playing to player coach and then to coach.
You started being a coach and an assistant coach and scout for the Knicks, the New York Knicks, in 1958. And you wrote that you had to travel about 100,000 miles a year. That is a lot of territory to cover. How would you map out your itinerary when you were coaching?
When you were scouting. When I was scouting, actually, I'd get all the players, you know, all the good players that we had to see. And, of course, your schedule can change in a second because somebody surfaces that's pretty good or a lot better than you thought he was going to be, or you get a tip about a guy like, you know, then you got to go off schedule. But what I'd do is I'd get a big map of the country, and I'd pin all these places. Then I'd plan trips based on where there was the most players to see. You know, I could go one day here, one day there, or maybe even sometimes do an afternoon. A lot of times I used to be on the road, pull into a motel and get a TV set and watch an afternoon game and then continue on to where I had to go. That, you know, you were very, very busy. It was a lot of fun. It was very, very exciting. It was tiresome. It kept you away from your family a lot, which was not good. But you sort of were out in limbo. You know, you were very often you were places where nobody knew you were, except you and whatever transportation you were taking.
Do you watch a game differently when you're watching it as a scout?
Oh, yeah. When you're scouting, you usually zero in on the player or players you're scouting and watch their moves. The ball may be 20 feet away from them, but you watch what they're doing. You watch what they do without the ball. You watch what they do defensively when they're involved head-on with their man or when they're involved away from the ball defensively, because there are many, many things you can do, many, many different positions you can take to overplay, to be in a position to help, to be in a position to see what's going on. So, and also you're watching to see what his court habits are. And that's very, very important.
Well, you say it's important that a player can score in a clutch, not just during garbage
that's
time.
That's right.
I really like that expression of garbage time.
Yeah, well, I tell you, though, as a coach, it's very important to get a guy that is not afraid to get the ball and do things when the game is on the line. You know, that's very important. But as a coach, you need a guy that's pretty good at garbage time, too, because if you're taking your regulars out, you're taking guys out to rest them, and they may feel you got a big lead and the game's over. Everybody thinks it's garbage time, but when you're playing with the 24-second clock, the lead can change drastically, and all of a sudden you got to put these fellows in, and you hate to do that because they're all sort of dried out, you know. So a garbage man is very important at that point. You know, we used to have a Cassie Russell come off the bench and he could score right away, and he was great at that. And if we had a team down, he made sure we kept him down when he went in there. And that was appreciated by me. I didn't consider that garbage time. I considered that important.
It's always been important to you to find players who would be willing to sacrifice for the team. When you're scouting, how can you tell who's willing to make the personal sacrifices for the team's greater good?
That's a difficult thing to do, but when you're scouting, you sort of talk to some people. You might be lucky enough to get in to watch a practice, or you go to the local restaurant, or you have a connection with a coach, an assistant coach, and you pick up things like that, and you know who the coaches are that are going to always be plugging their player rather than giving you all the facts. Some of them want to see their player do well, and you can't blame him for that. But some of them will tell you that he can do this, but he needs a little help here, and then you get into attitudes and things, and then of course you're reading every paper in the country practically, so and you're on the phone, you're calling people in areas, and you pick up a lot of stuff that way.
Red Holtzman is my guest. He has written an autobiography titled Red on Red. He has been a player, and with the Knicks, he's been a scout and a coach during his five decades in basketball, and he was recently inducted into the Basketball Hall of Fame. Now, I was surprised to read that when you were first offered the job of coaching the New York Knicks, that you didn't want it. Why not? This was in around 1967.
Yes. Yeah, well, I'd been through all that in St. Louis, you know, and they let me go there after I coached for about 3.5 years. And I thought that this was a nice job in New York. I was close to home and had some security, you know. And I was very content. I was happy at what I was doing. They were really a first-class outfit. New York Knicks have always been, you know, I traveled well, and they really took good care of me. So I thought that I really didn't want to change, you know. But then when I was told that I was it, you know, I was going to be the coach, and the bug, after I started coaching, the bug got me again, you know, and I started enjoying it, and then I wasn't sure if I wanted to go back to scouting or not, and they didn't want me to go back, of course, we did pretty well, and I got into the coaching end of it, and I enjoyed it.
Well, you'd put together a lot of that team, some of the players that you found. You'd scouted Dick Van Arsdale, Cassie Russell, Walt Frazier, some of the leading players.
Yeah, I'd scouted all those guys, Willis Reed and Bill Bradley and, you know, all these guys. And Dave DeBusschere, of course, was drafted by somebody else, but I had scouted him as well, and we always felt that he would be a great addition if we could get him. And we were fortunate enough to make a deal for him. But all the other guys were people that I had scouted previously.
Well, they must have had a lot of loyalty to you. You launched their professional career.
Yeah, well, they did. And, you know, they're ambitious. They have loyalty to people, and they have a lot of loyalty to their careers and to themselves. And they have to be that way. You know, the ball players are tough. They're very, very tough, and they're very, very ambitious.
You've said that you think that frequently it's the fringe players who make better coaches than the great players do.
Yeah, I think very often the great player has had things, he's done things so well that he expects everybody to do what he's done instantly. And many, many times these great players, they don't even know how they did it. You know, they just do it naturally. And it comes up, and they do it. Whereas the guy that's sitting around, he's the fringe player, he's watching, he's seeing what's going on, and he's studying, and he's waiting for his opportunity, and he's constantly in the ball game thinking all the time. Now, the great players do that too, but I think the other guys have been more observant and don't expect you to do so much and try to teach you to do the things that will make you a better player.
Well, especially with your experience as a scout, you knew what your players were capable of doing, but it was your job to bring it out in them and to get them to do it. What were some of your techniques for getting the best performance from your players?
Well, I think the most important thing that we tried to do when I came in was to get them to play a brand of team basketball that would help us. I felt that you get teams that don't play as a team, no matter how much talent they have, they're not going to be a winning team. So that was the first thing we had in mind, is to instill pride in being part of a team type of thing. And the next, almost as important, is to get them to play good team defense, because I think if you study basketball a little bit, you'll find that there's almost never been a good team, a team that's won, that has won without playing good team basketball, good team defense. So very often your defense makes your offense, and these are the things that make for good teams, those two things. And then to put your talents in the team and use it together, do all the things together. And that's what they did. They were a very, very intelligent group.
Well, as we discussed before, you've always put teamwork above individual stars. Did that get harder to do over the years? Did it get harder to have the players really function as a team as opposed to just going for their own statistics?
I think it did. I think it got harder over the years because the money became more of a factor. The money got, you know, very, very big, and you couldn't blame players for wanting to make more money or striving to make more money. And a lot of them thought that the only way to get it was to shoot a lot and score a lot. Of course, that was not always true. If they didn't have the ability to do that, they fell by the wayside. So I think that the money factor took away from that aspect of the game a little bit. But of course, the good teams do these team things and do these team defensive things together.
Do you think that fans appreciate good teamwork as much as they appreciate someone who can make a lot of baskets, do a lot of shooting?
I think they like to see outstanding players, and they like to see players do outstanding things on an individual basis. But they like to see good team basketball, and they like to see good team basketball if it gets results. If you're out there and you're not getting results, then they're not going to buy it. They're going to say, yeah, that stuff doesn't work, you know, and I think my main job also when I took over the team was to do a selling job on them and to tell them that the stuff that I was laying down there and teaching them was going to work. And, you know, if we lost a couple of games and if we lost some more, I don't know what would have happened. You know, they might not have bought it and say, well, this guy, you know, I don't know what if he knows what he's talking about. But the thing is that if it does work, everybody is a part of it, and they're proud of it. You know, all of a sudden we know something that somebody else don't know, you know, and we're pressing. Our defense was a pressing type of defense, and it was working. So that was a great thing.
Was there something that you always felt, well, if I were a coach, I would do it this way? Something like that you actually were able to put into effect once you started coaching?
Well, I think that, you know, that's inherent in everybody that's been involved in anything, you know. If you really love it and are serious about it, you're always thinking about something that you would do that would be better than what's being done. And my background was with, you know, people who had me play this type of defense, this type of basketball, this type of stuff that we did in the schoolyards in Brooklyn, you know. And I played for guys like Nat Holman, who was a great coach at City College. And I played up in Rochester, you know, so all this stuff was based on the team stuff, passing the ball and helping each other, playing good defense. So it was in my background, you know, it was always there, and I always felt that was the number one way to go.
My guest is Red Holtzman. He's been a player, scout, coach, and general manager during his 5 decades in basketball. He coached the New York Knicks to their world championship, and in 1986 he was inducted into the Basketball Hall of Fame. He's written an autobiography. It's titled Red on Red. We'll talk more after we take this short break. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live at WHYY in Philadelphia and distributed by National Public Radio.
Former New York Knicks basketball coach Red Holtzman is my guest. Part of what you have to do as a coach is be a disciplinarian. What were the kinds of things that you would institute penalties or fines for from your players?
Well, that's very true about being a disciplinarian. You have to do that, but you can also make a game out of it. You know, I was a stickler on being on time. I felt that if you came on time and you thought about that, you played on time and you played better, and you had respect for your teammates, you had respect for your coaches, and you had respect for yourself by being there on time. And it made a better unit, I felt. So that was one of them. And we'd give them little fines, you know, and at first, you know, $5, $10, maybe more for other things. And we'd keep a pool and let them have a party at the end of the year. But rather than making it a stern type of thing, you're fine, you know, and get that type of attitude, we made it a fun type of thing where the players were finding each other. They were watching the clock. Oh, we got this guy, he's late, you know, and things like that. And that made it fun, but it got the result. It got them where they were on time. And also when we were playing, it got them doing the things we expected them to do. And it worked out. And it worked out without any animosity and with it becoming fun and sort of getting us into where we were some sort of a happy family. You know, usually basketball players don't stick together too long after they leave their practice sessions or the road or whatever, you know. They go their separate ways. But on the road, practice, games, we were pretty tight.
I can't imagine a $5 to $10 penalty being something that really scares the heck out of a highly paid basketball player.
No. But we did have higher fines. You know, we'd have a $100 fine, $500 fine, $200. Oh, we had that, sure.
You didn't mention that.
You know what? With today's salaries, that doesn't scare them either.
Right.
But the idea is they don't like to have their teammates laugh, you know, and say, oh, we got you. You're going to pay this fine. And they're standing there laughing. So they can't wait to get the other guy, you know. So it was a fun type of thing. I think, you know, it's like when you get a ticket, you know, you can afford to pay $30-$40. But as soon as you get it, you get a feeling like you did something that you shouldn't have done. And you're not happy about it.
Whenever you watch a basketball game on TV, there are, of course, cutaways from the court to the coach on the sidelines who's really in a panic and shouting and screaming and urging on the players. Did you dread those cutaway shots to you?
Well, I didn't dread them because I was too busy trying to do what I could do. But, you know, you have to have a lot of ego and you got to be a little crazy to be a coach, you know, and you got to make a fool of yourself occasionally. So we all did that. But we don't like the word panic because we're supposed to be cool, you know, although I guess we did that too. But the cutaway shots were part of the business. And the only thing I didn't like about, and I wouldn't let people do it, is take their mics into the huddle, you know, with timeouts and things like that. I figured we ought to have some secrets, you know, and everybody say, oh, boy, I wonder what he's telling them now, something brilliant, I suppose, you know, and maybe I'm telling the guy to get the bus warm or something and we'll be out and we're going to go to dinner early or something like that. But you got to have some secrets, and that's one thing I didn't go for.
What are some of the typical things that you would yell from the sidelines to your players, things that would be clean enough to mention on the radio?
Well, I think I was pretty clean most of the time. Most of the time, I stray once in a while. But mostly I would be concerned with what they were doing on defense because, as I said, that's where everything starts. Your defense is where everything starts and gets you into your offense. Mostly to see the ball. There's a tendency of guys on defense not to see the ball. So they would hear that till they got sick of it, you know, and That's mainly the thing. See the ball, and then you know maybe a little expletive if they didn't do it after the five times or something, you know. But that's all game that went on. Get up there or get back, you know. All these little things to make them alert, make them aware of what's going on, make them aware of what's coming up, and things like that. Because there are tendencies for people to lose concentration in sports. That's why we say, like, when you're making screens, if you make a screen, the guy can concentrate and get over it the first time. If you do it the second time, he's just about getting over it. If you do it the third time, he's maybe not thinking about getting over it, and then you get free. So you need patience defensively, concentration defensively, and you need the same thing on the offense.
You know, speaking of coaching and how you look on the sidelines during a game, you described something very funny. You were coaching for a while in Puerto Rico, and some of the fans didn't really think of you as an authentic coach because you weren't holding a clipboard.
Yeah, that was we used to play in baseball parks there, and when we had practice in the local town, I coached in Ponce, Puerto Rico, and they'd always come out, especially when there was a new coach there, they'd sit in the dark stands, and you could see them up there. They'd be smoking cigarettes and all the lights, and they, for the first time in their lives, and they've had some great coaches there. They had, you know, a fellow like Jack Ramsey coached there, and a good number of real top-notch coaches. And I came there, and for the first time, I didn't have a clipboard. Well, they couldn't understand that. They thought I was an imposter, you know. And they got a hold of the guy that owns the team, and they said that you got to get rid of this guy. He's not really a coach. He doesn't have a clipboard. You can't coach if you don't have a clipboard. But he explained to them that he thought I was a coach and that he was going to give me a chance. And it turned out well because I was there for 4 years and we won 3 championships.
You have been in basketball throughout the history of the NBA. Are there any rules that were instituted by the NBA that you think really changed the sport for the better or for the worse?
Well, the first one was that 24-second clock. I think that made it a better game for the fans, you know, And to the credit of the NBA, and they've always made rule changes that would help the fans enjoy the game more, make the game a better game, and take some judgment away from officials, and that makes it better. Now, there have been many, many. They've widened the lanes at times, and they've done a lot of things. 24 seconds, as I said, and And of course, they play 48 minutes, and they have last 2 minutes. The clock is dead on everything, and the last minute of the half. And it's a great game in that respect. They're always trying to figure out a way for the team behind to get back in the ball game or get out front. Now, when that happens, it's interesting. People are not apt to leave as much because in the NBA, it's exciting. If you're 10 points down and there's 2 minutes to go, you could win by 3-4 points with 2 minutes. So that keeps the game great, and the players that they have keep the game great, and it's just going to get better and better, I think.
Back when you were a scout, you were scouting at Grambling College, which is a Southern Black college. And in your book, you write that it was interesting that all the players were Black, but a lot of the white students from nearby colleges had come and were cheering on the students from Grambling. And you said that you thought this really foreshadowed how the NBA would change. Would you explain that?
Yeah, well, at that time, Grambling played some of the best basketball around, you know. That was before all the big colleges were taking Black players, and they really had the best players in the country. We got Willis Reed from Grambling, and the people who were basketball fans who wanted to see good basketball came to Grambling. They went there to see it, and all these great players were being watched in the small colleges. It didn't make any difference where you went. You went to see the best players, and that's where they were. So I think that this was a sign of things that were going to happen, and it was great.
Well, I think when you started playing, there were virtually no Black professional players.
There were almost no Black professional players except some teams that were entirely Black teams, like the New York Renaissance, who were a great, great basketball team, and the Harlem Globetrotters and the Washington Generals. They had some great, great all-Black teams, but in the National League and later on, actually, the Rochester Royals, who were owned by Lester Harrison, the guy that owned my team there, was the first man to sign Black players. He signed two great Black players out of New York, Dolly King and Pop Gates. And he was actually the first man to do that. And I think it's to his credit because, it was a start and it helped.
Now that you're retired, are you still doing any consulting?
I'm a consultant. I'm available to be consulted. I hope it's about basketball because otherwise we'd be in trouble. But I'm available. But, the trouble with being consulted too much in basketball is that you're not there every day. You're not in on the daily things that are happening. So it's a little difficult. But a consultant is a guy that you might ask something once in a while. But basically a consultant is a guy that you owe money to. And
an interesting definition. I'll remember that.
Remember that. That if you ever get old enough to get a consultant's job, grab it. It's a great job. The Knicks have been very, very nice. They treat me with a great deal of respect. And it's just a joy to go to the games at the Garden. And my wife and I have a lot of fun, and it keeps us busy. And if I'm there and I can help, I'm always glad to do that.
Let me ask you, if you were getting started today as a player, do you think you'd make it into the NBA? Have standards changed a lot?
I think I would have a great deal of trouble making the NBA because I'm about a little over 5'9", and I was a good player. But, I think you got guys today who are my height that can really jump and really can do a lot of other things that possibly would make it difficult. I had the physical strength because I weighed about 180 pounds and I was strong. But I think it would be very, very difficult to be given the chance. Maybe if I got the chance, I could play some. But it would be hard.
Red Holzman, I want to thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you.
My guest has been Red Holzman, and he's written about his 5 decades in professional basketball in his new autobiography, which is titled Red on Red and is published by Bantam Books. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Funding for Fresh Air is provided by a major grant from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and a grant from Fisher's World Travel Guides. Fisher's World Guidebooks featuring the removable travel planner designed for the intelligent, inquisitive traveler. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY-FM in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Coming up, crime writer Charles Williford talks about his creation, Miami police detective Hoke Mosley. He's written three Mosley novels, all commercial and critical successes. It's quite a change from the 50s when Williford struggled to sell his pulp novels. Also today, rock historian Ed Ward profiles the Standells. Their song Dirty Water was a hit in the 60s. The group's been back in the news since police in Texas caught someone impersonating the Standells' lead singer. And book critic John Leonard reviews Arthur C. Clarke's 2061. It follows Clarke's bestsellers 2001 A Space Odyssey and 2010. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news from National Public Radio.
I'm Sharon Green in Washington. The Reagan-Gorbachev summit began today with the signing of a treaty to eliminate medium-range missiles from Europe. Afterward, the two leaders met to discuss other issues that separate the superpowers. NPR's Brian Naylor has details.
Mr. Reagan noted he first proposed the zero-zero option on which the treaty was based 6 years ago. In remarks before the two leaders signed leather-bound copies of the document, the president called the finished product an excellent example of the rewards of patience. The president assured the members of Congress present in the East Room that the agreement contained strict verification procedures, and he repeated his now famous recitation of his favorite Soviet proverb, prompting a quip from the General Secretary.
The maxim is, dovayai, no provayai. Trust, but verify.
Назначение этого...
На каждой встрече вы это повторяете.
You repeat that at every meeting.
The leaders held two meetings at the White House today and formed two working groups. The president also presented the general secretary with a pair of gold cufflinks picturing the biblical prophet Isaiah breaking swords into plowshares. I'm Brian Naylor in Washington.
FBI investigators today said the Pacific Southwest Airlines jet crash in California that killed 43 people may not have been an accident. Flight 1771 crashed last night en route from Los Angeles to San Francisco after the pilot reportedly radioed that there was gunfire on board and smoke in the cockpit. Speaking to reporters in Los Angeles, FBI Special Agent Richard Bretzling said officials now suspect that a criminal act may have caused the crash.
What we're doing now is taking a much sharper focus on the potential criminal activity that brought this plane down. We believe there to be a substantially increased basis for concluding that, in fact, criminal activity did bring this aircraft down, and that is based not only on the tape that the air traffic controllers have, but on other investigation which we are conducting outside of this area.
According to an ABC News report today, a U.S. Air employee who was fired last week smuggled a handgun on board the plane after learning that his former boss was on the flight. The network reported that the disgruntled man intended to kill his one-time manager and that the unidentified employee left a suicide note. ABC said the man was fired after 18 years for alleged drinking and stealing. While not confirming the report, a spokeswoman for U.S. Air confirmed that the dead included a fired airline employee and his former boss. Pacific Southwest Airlines is a subsidiary of U.S. Air. In South Africa's strife-torn black townships near the town of Pietermaritzburg, seven more people have been killed in political violence. NPR's John Madison has details.
10 people have died since the weekend, 7 in the last 24 hours, in clashes after a rally by the anti-apartheid United Democratic Front. The rally was aimed at preparing the ground for peace talks with the rival Inkatha movement of Zulu chief Mangosuthu Buthelezi. Clashes between the two groups have left over 200 dead in the last few months, and 7 officials of Buthelezi's Inkatha movement have now been ordered by the courts to keep away from their opponents. Affidavits had linked them to several political killings. Police said 35 people were arrested today. I'm John Madison in Johannesburg.
Closing arguments began today in the New York trial of 4 white teenagers charged with chasing a black man to his death last December on a highway in the Howard Beach section of Queens. The case is expected to go to the jury by week's end. The Dow Jones Industrial Average ended the day 56 points higher at 1868.37. I'm Sharon Green, NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. You may have heard about a rock and roll hoax that was foiled in Texas recently. Someone was posing as Dick Dodd, who led the group The Standells back in the mid-60s. The imposter had a lot of people fooled before he was busted. We asked our rock and roll historian, Ed Ward, to investigate the real Standells.
My friend Steve Chaney and his nightclub Big Mamu down here in Austin, Texas, made the news a few weeks ago, thanks to Steve's carefully orchestrated arrest of a guy claiming to be Dick Dodd, the leader of the Standells. But who were the Standells? Rock and roll historians refer to the Standells as the best of the Ed Cobb bands, the forefront of the American 60s punk sound. That won't tell you much, but this will.
I'm gonna tell you about my town. I'm gonna tell you a big fat story, baby. I'll talk about my town. Yeah, down by the river, down by the banks of the River Charles. Ah, that's what's happening, baby. That's where you'll find me.
Water became a smash early in 1966 and put this former clean-cut copy band from San Jose on the map. They'd gotten a gig playing the hits at PJ's on the Sunset Strip, and this had led to some walk-on parts on TV shows like The Munsters and in such deathless films as Zebra in the Kitchen. One of the band, Larry Tamblyn, was the brother of Russ Tamblyn, who played Riff in the movie West Side Story, and Dick Dodd had been a Mouseketeer, so they were no strangers to showbiz. Still, hooking up with songwriter Ed Cobb, a former member of the Four Preps, was a very lucky break. Cobb was a trend watcher, and he knew that a squeaky clean band wasn't what American teens wanted. He groomed the Standells into a sort of American version of the Rolling Stones, handed them Dirty Water, which he'd written after visiting his girlfriend in Boston, and let Dick Dodd sneer it into a microphone. The Standells were on their way. As the band got ready to open for the Rolling Stones on their 1966 tour, Cobb solidified their us-versus-them position with American teenagers by putting out Sometimes Good Guys Don't Wear White. Like the punks they'd become, the Standells got pushier. Early in 1967, they released a song called Try It, which unfortunately I don't have a copy of, and although it took off in L.A., it was quickly banned. What were they trying to get the girl to try? Was it sex or drugs? Well, it hardly mattered. It was the way they went about it. Losing that record was a major setback, but fortunately they had recorded the theme to what looked like a very timely movie about to come out, Riot on Sunset Strip.
I'm going down to the strip tonight. I'm not on a stay-home trip tonight. Long hair seems to be the main attraction, but the heat is causing all the action. Bright lights everywhere, pretty girls with long, long hair. But so now the people, they don't care. Just doesn't seem fair to bug you 'cause you got long hair. Even the parents are beginning to stare because of the siren on our streets that used to be neat, but now it's just a place for black and white cars to race. It's causing a riot.
But the movie flopped, and the Standells, finding themselves suddenly unfashionable for their lack of psychedelia, disappeared into history. Maybe that's why the former car thief who presented himself as Dick Dodd in Austin thought nobody would remember. Ah, but the real Dick Dodd flew in from California and blew the whistle. As they led the imposter away, I wonder if Dick remembered this song, recorded 20 years ago.
Have you ever spent the night in jail? Well, I have. Have you ever spent the night in jail? Well, I have. Have you ever ate that refried food? Yeah, you got some sick.
Ed Ward is co-author of Rock of Ages, The Rolling Stone History of Rock and Roll. He also writes for the Austin Chronicle. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Charles Williford, a writer of bleak existential crime novels.
I'm going to kill you, he said through his clenched teeth. Both of you. I don't blame you, I answered calmly. I felt no fear or anxiety at all, just a morbid feeling of detachment.
That morbid feeling of detachment recurs in Williford's early novels. The reading is from Williford's book Pickup, which he wrote in the 1950s, shortly before retiring from the military. Back then, it was hard to get his books published, and most of them ended up getting brought out as pulps. Now Williford's early books are being read in a new light. Black Lizard Press reissued Pickup, The Burnt Orange Heresy, and Cockfighter. Research Arts has resurrected his first novels, High Priest of California and Wild Wives. Literary acclaim for these new editions coincides with the publication of his current series of crime novels, set in Miami, featuring police detective Hoke Mosley. Well, when we left the main characters of Pickup, Harry and Helen, they were facing a man who was waving a pistol and threatening to kill them. The would-be killer backs down, and Helen says,
"Did you feel sorry for him, Harry?" "I did," Helen said. "Yes, I did," I replied sincerely, "the poor bastard. I don't believe I'd have really cared if he killed us both." Helen's voice was reflective, somber. "Cared?" I forced a tight smile. "It would have been a favor."
I have to tell you, when I read that for the first time, it was so bleak, I found myself laughing. Was that an inappropriate response?
Yeah, well, this is a novel of despair. They both lost already before the book starts. And they can only go down from there.
You know, in your latest book, Sideswipe, the book opens with a quotation that says, "Life is an effort that deserves a better cause." Do you think that bleakness and indifference to life, despair, is a theme that runs through many of your books?
Well, usually, yes. But I think there's enough humor with it to alleviate it. Although I have had people say after they finished Pickup, they wanted to cut their wrists. But I said, well, you know, a lot of people like this kind of thing. And people like to read about people who are worse off than they are.
I guess that's true. you've had a pretty extraordinary life, and I'm sure that the things that have happened during your life have shaped your writing. You were orphaned when you were 8 years old. Your parents, I believe, died of tuberculosis.
Yes.
You went to live with your grandmother. And at 15, you became a hobo. How come?
Well, things were pretty tight after my grandmother lost her job. My uncle, her son, had to support her. And he was married with three children. And I was kind of, I had to do something, you know, and he couldn't very well support me, and I was too young to work, so I went on the road.
Did you have to learn how to talk a good game in order to stay alive when you were on the road?
Yeah, pretty much. Pretty much, you get to be pretty glib.
Did that help you in your writing, do you think?
Well, yes, but I read a lot, too. I always read a lot, you know. Even when I was going to school, I used to read a book a day just about.
In your novel, Pickup, the characters basically live for the next bottle of alcohol, the next cigarette, the next cup of coffee. Did you meet up with characters like that or feel that you were becoming that way yourself when you were a hobo?
No. I was always optimistic, you know, and I always had some goal of some kind, even if the goal was getting to someplace else. I had a destination in mind. A guy told me that. He says, you always want to have a destination in mind. If you don't, you'll drift. And he says, when you get to that destination, he says, pick out another one and go immediately to that. He says, then you that way you won't get into despair and drift.
That's really interesting advice.
Mm-hmm. It is good advice.
Now, at age 16, you lied about your age and you enlisted. How mm-hmm. come?
Well, it was a way out, and I figured the Army was the best place for me to go. I'd come back home, and the situation hadn't changed any. And I was big for my age, and I was able to get in, so I went in. And it was probably the best thing I could have done at the time. The Depression was still on. There was no place for a 16-year-old boy in civilian life.
I still get, you know, I have this impression of you that you're someone who was really, like, born to be a bohemian who ended up in the military.
Yeah, well, you do what you have to do, you know. And I kind of liked the Army anyway. I kind of liked it.
What'd you like about it?
Well, I liked the trade. I liked the weapons, and I liked playing soldier, and I liked fighting in the war. And I always felt that I had a charmed life, and I never get hit. But I did. I got wounded a couple times anyway, but not bad.
You started writing novels while you were still in the military, right?
Yes, I did. I was still in the Air Force and had written some short stories, and I'd always wanted to write a novel. I used to keep saying, I'm going to write a novel. And my roommate finally said, you're never going to write a novel. So that's what I did. I was up at Hamilton Air Force Base, and I used to go into San Francisco on the weekends and rent a hotel room, the Hotel Powell there. And started on this novel, and I finally finished it, you know, on the weekends.
When did you decide to leave the military?
When I leave the military?
Yeah.
Well, I didn't decide. I just retired. I stayed in for 20 years. As a tank commander, I didn't have any other particular trade, so I decided to stay in.
Well, except for writing.
Well, except for writing. But, you know, that was an iffy thing, and it was a kind of a way to supplement your income occasionally, but to write full-time and support yourself is a tough proposition in this country.
When did you actually reach that point of being able to support yourself on your writing?
Oh, about by 1982, I've been able to support myself.
And that's when you were writing the Hoke Mosley detective
mm-hmm.
novel?
Yeah, the Detective Mosley series has kind of taken off now. You know, there's been three Miami Blues, New Hope for the Dead, and Sideswipe. Sideswipe's coming out in paperback soon. And then there's a fourth novel coming out in April from Random House called The Way We Die Now. And Hoke Mosley's pretty popular.
For the past few years, all of your novels have been about Detective Hoke Mosley. Why did you want to do a detective series that had a recurring character in it?
Well, what I wanted to do... I wanted to write about a detective. I didn't want to do a private eye. And I kind of made up my own Miami police force and my own homicide thing. And then I wrote a long biography of Hoak Mosely. I know everything about him, you know, where he's from and his first kiss and his grades in school and everything else. I have did a lot of background to invent this character. And then after I finished the first novel with him, well, I said, well, I might as well continue on and write another one because I have all this information, you see. All I need is another plot.
Which of the characters that you've created for your novels is closest to you?
I hope that none of them are close to me.
Because they're all crazy.
Yeah. I think that my autobiography there is something about a soldier. That's me. That's the way I was. But in the characterizations of my heroes and villains and so on in my novels, I don't think I have any of their characteristics. They're invented, created characters.
Well, one last thing. In a lot of your novels, you're interested in people who are sociopaths, who are crazy, and who operate by this really strict set of logic, but the logic is nuts, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Why are you interested in characters like that?
Well, I was told back in 1958, I was in a writer's class, and I was told that it's impossible to make a crazy person sympathetic, so don't ever do that. And I went home and I thought about it. I said, well, that's not impossible. I can make a sympathetic character out of a crazy person. And so I wrote this short story, The Machine in War 11, about a movie director who was crazy, you know, who ended up killing his psychiatrist. And he was sympathetic. And I sent the story into Playboy, and they bought it for $3,000. And he was a sympathetic character, and that gave me the idea. Well, I realized that it's the crazy people in this world who do anything anyway. It makes life exciting, and people want to read about them because their lives are so dull.
Well, Charles Williford, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Well, I enjoyed it.
Charles Williford's three Hoak Mosely detective novels are Miami Blues, New Hope for the Dead, and Sideswipe. This is Fresh Air. You can hear full coverage of today's news on All Things Considered. Renee Montagne co-hosts the program, and she's joining us from Washington. Hi, Renee.
Hi, Terry.
Well, today is the first day of the summit.
Yes, it is. And on this first day, the big event. President Reagan and Soviet leader Gorbachev signed the INF Treaty. After years of negotiating, they have banned Soviet and U.S. medium-range nuclear missiles in Europe. We'll talk tonight on All Things Considered with experts about what this means for Soviet-U.S. relations and how we arrived at this moment. We take a listen to the conservative view on the treaty. And also, I went over to the Glasnost Cafe at the Marriott Hotel, where the International Press Corps gathers each day, to talk with them about how they're covering this summit, how they're showing their listeners and readers what we're like here in America.
Thanks, Renee. Those stories and more coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Arthur C. Clarke's Space Odyssey isn't over yet. The author of 2001, A Space Odyssey, and 2010 has a new book titled 2061. Our book critic John Leonard has this review.
You might not remember that back in 1968, before we landed anybody on the moon, when Stanley Kubrick was making the movie version of 2001, A Space Odyssey, Arthur C. Clarke was simultaneously writing the book version, and they were different. In the movie, the spaceship Discovery and its computer HAL went to Jupiter, where they were traumatized by the slab-like monolith. Critics of the movie, depending on which stage they'd reached in their analysis, interpreted this monolith as a door, a bed, a tombstone, a domino, a trampoline, a mosaic tablet, and so on. In the book, Discovery went instead to Saturn, and the monolith was pretty clearly some sort of computer. Nor in the book was there any music, no Johann or Richard Strauss. Mr. Clarke, who's been writing science fiction novels for more than 40 years, hears very little music. He's more of a nuts and bolts deep space tripper, a writer of boys' books. But Mr. Clarke is also flexible and obliging. Since more people had seen the movie than read the book, when he got around to his first sequel, 2010, he forgot all about Saturn. Instead, he turned Jupiter into a second sun called Lucifer, and its moons, like Europa and Ganymede, into planets. Earthlings, including Chinese communists, were warned to stay away from Europa, a kind of lab where the monoliths were conducting unspecified experiments in alien intelligence. Mr. Clark hoped to wait until 1990 to write a third volume, by which time the Space Shuttle Challenger would have launched a deep probe of Jupiter, and he'd have lots of facts to play with. Unfortunately, Challenger never got off the ground. And so Mr. Clark jumps the gun again in 2061. After all, the new sun will only be around for 1,000 years, and already there's this weird crystal mountain on the plains of Europa, and the Earthlings are itchy, maybe because with two suns now beating down on them, they don't get as much sleep as they used to. Before we get to Europa, on a rescue mission involving 21st century South African politics that I refuse to explain or believe, we make a stop on Halley's Comet for a pick-me-up from one of the geysers. We're ready, then, to meet a whole new species of shark that can't stomach human meat, to look at igloos in the shadow of the monolith from which unseen but reptilian life forms have fled our approach, to be clued in on the extinction of a race of flying gas bags that failed to evolve to the advanced intelligence of, say, a Stanley Kubrick, and to climb the Crystal Mountain. The secret of the Crystal Mountain, revealed on page 221, will come as no surprise to the reader who was paying attention on page 68, but there are lots of other interesting secrets, and a fine imagination of alien biochemical possibilities, and such a benign perspective on what the future will look like that you will be ashamed of your own paranoia. It's all fun, a sort of quick-fix microwave fiction. Mr. Clark seems to be a happy man and wishes we were too.
John Leonard writes about television for New York Magazine and is a columnist for New York Newsday. He reviewed Arthur C. Clarke's new book, 2061. Here's a look at tomorrow's fresh air. Tomorrow I'll speak with sports writer and boxing analyst Larry Merchant. He's covered boxing as a newspaper reporter and television commentator and says that television has changed the sport. Also, classical music critic Lord Schwartz will review a recent recording of Alexander Zemlinsky's The Mermaid, a symphony neglected for almost 80 years. And language commentator Jeffrey Nunberg will discuss whether it's possible or even desirable to eliminate gender bias in language. So I hope you can join us. We thank everyone who helps make Fresh Air possible.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced.
Our senior producer is Danny Miller. Our producers are Amy Salad, Phyllis Myers, and Naomi Person. Ed Doherty and Lisa Bruton are the production assistants. Our engineer is Joyce Lieberman. Chris Spurgeon directs the show. I'm Terry Gross. Thanks for listening. This is NPR, National Public Radio.